mountains, deserts and streams. The rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. Sam Nagri is the author of Be on the Lookout for Man-Eating Birds and Other Wildlife When Traveling from the Little Painted Desert to the Main Painted Desert. The big bird ate the man. Then another man sat down in front of a rock and etched a picture of the big bird eating the man. About 900 years later, a visitor showed up in northern Arizona, stood in front of the rock drawing, and asked, "Why is that bird eating a man?" But everybody who might know died long ago, so the visitor made a note. Watch out for man-eating birds in the petrified forest. I took the memory of that bird home with me. I started out this hot, late May day on a loop drive that would take me from Little Painted Desert County Park, 13 miles north of Winslow, to the Main Painted Desert, about 60 miles to the east in the northern part of Petrified Forest National Park. And man-eating birds were the last thing on my mind. Instead, thoughts of how different the two painted deserts appear consume me. At first sight, it seemed the Little Painted Desert, really just a pullout with a couple of ramadas, could use a new coat of paint. In the bright morning light, the hills that unfolded below me showed the color of iced tea, dark iced tea. Later in the day, I knew the sunlight would transform the hills from shades of orange and brown to grays and blacks. Claude Monet wouldn't have been impressed. But this is not the south of France. This is the arid Colorado plateau between Winslow and Holbrook, a place that, with luck, will get a wine glass of water during an entire year. Still, the uncrowded Little Painted Desert offers a hint of its much larger counterpart, a 43,000, 20-acre undulating expanse of clay soils laced with a rainbow of materials, and plenty of worthwhile destinations awaited between the two spots. Leaving the overlook at the county park, I headed south on State Route 87, about 12 miles to Homolovi Ruins State Park, one of the most memorable stops along this route. Homolovi preserves the ruins of 13th and 14th century villages along the Little Colorado, built by the Hissatsunum ancestors of the modern Hopi Indians who live north of here in the villages on Black Mesa. The ruins I found consist of piles of rubble, low walls, and an excavated kiva. Fragments of ancient pottery lie everywhere. Removing the potsherds is forbidden, and respectful visitors have placed on rocks along the pass the bits of decorated ceramics they found. Some form of tactile communication was going on. Visitors have made little circles and spirals and mosaics with the shards. We are all strangers, they say, but we are talking to each other across the centuries. Continuing south on State 87, I crossed a bridge over Interstate 40 and swung west into the center of Winslow, where the highway takes a 90-degree turn to the south. A mile south of Winslow, I turned east onto State 99. As I drove the next 5 miles to McHood Park, I kept looking for pronghorn antelopes, which are abundant in this area. I'd seen them many times before when driving through these plats, but evidently this weekend they'd all gone camping. McHood Park straddles the green waters of Clear Creek Reservoir, fed by a year-round stream. Even though it was a weekend, I encountered only a handful of fishermen. I'd been planning to buy an inflatable boat for places like this. Rowing between the cliffs along Clear Lake would have been a delightful way to spend a couple of hours. Territorial Road, also known as McLaws Road, heads east off 99, 2 miles south of the park. The next 19 miles of graded dirt road traverse the broad plateau that runs more or less parallel to the Little Colorado River between Winslow and the outskirts of Joseph City. After traveling 7 miles east of Winslow and Territorial Road, I came to the narrow bridge that crosses Chevelon Canyon, a deep and rocky fissure that extends from the Little Colorado River south to Heber. At a couple of spots in the cliffs near the bridge lie reminders of the days when this road, one of only two places where you can drive across the green depths of Chevelon Canyon, was the main east-west route connecting Albuquerque and Prescott. Advertisements painted on the rocks early in the 20th century to lure travelers to stores in Winslow now appear barely visible. 12 miles east of the bridge, I was back on pavement, and 10 miles later, the road came to a T at U.S. Route 180, marked Apache. I hung a right, and after 18 miles, came to the entrance on my left for Petrified Forest National Park. I didn't remember paying an entrance fee the last time I visited, but now it costs $10 per car. After 3 miles, I came to the first self-guided trail, a museum, restaurant, and gift shop. A map in the museum shows that petrified wood has been found in every state of the nation, but nowhere are these logs turned to stone more abundant than in the petrified forest. I continued north another 15 miles and stopped at the Puerco Pueblo viewpoint. Only the foundations and a kiva remain of what was, 9 centuries ago, a 76-room pueblo. Many petroglyphs, including the man-eating bird, cover huge rocks near the ruin. When I got to the Painted Deserts Visitor Center, 10 miles up the road, I asked about this bird. A young man at the desk said, "There's some thought that it might not be a man, it might be a frog." I thought, "If that's a frog, I'll eat my pajamas." Of the several viewpoints in the Painted Desert, most inspiring are those at Pintado Point and the Painter Desert Inn, once a lodge and now a National Historic Landmark and Visitor Center. For as far as the eye can see from any of the viewpoints, the plain below looks like a three-dimensional quilt of cone-shaped hills streaked with deep red and black minerals. From the Painted Desert Inn overlook, you can walk a trail that leads off the hilltop and down through the colorful landscape. As I exited the Painted Desert, the road led me directly to Interstate 40. It's 60 miles west to Winslow from the Painted Desert Visitor Center. In all, this loop covers 178 miles, and there was no shortage of places to see. Best of all, I did not encounter a single man-eating bird. And this concludes, be on the lookout for man-eating birds and other wildlife when traveling from the Little Painted Desert to the Main Painted Desert. Jean Parrott is also the author of The Optimum Body May Exclude the Beautiful People. Arizona has a broad range of climates and environments. She also has elevations that range from below sea level to mountains that peak at about 1,500 feet above the tree line. Consequently, many creatures, large and small, feathered and furry, swarming, swimming, swooping, running, jumping, and crawling, find a comfortable, convenient home somewhere in the Grand Canyon State. Animals are interesting creatures to watch and learn from, and sometimes to envy. Homo sapiens considers itself the crown jewel of the animal kingdom. I don't. Oh, sure, a few of us can think intelligently, can solve problems, and have an opposable thumb, which gives us a slight advantage. But we're not the master species that we consider ourselves. In many ways, our bodies are hopelessly inadequate. I defy any of you to chop down a tree using your teeth. Have you ever tried sucking nectar from a flower? How about swooping down from hundreds of feet in the air and landing bottom first on a cactus? Still feel superior? If I were to design the optimum body, I'd select various features from other creatures. I'd start with the skin of a porcupine. That's right, a porcupine. I could go into any movie theater or board any airplane and never have to worry that the person next to me would hog the armrest. And while I was standing in line for the theater, no one would ever try to sneak ahead of me. It just wouldn't happen. With an outer covering of porcupine quills, I could have spent my entire childhood without ever getting spanked by mom or dad. Better yet, I would never have had to endure one of those rib-crushing goodbye hugs from huge, powerful Aunt Gladys. Yes, I'd definitely start with porcupine skin. I'd add the eyes of an eagle, a bird that soars high yet can spot its prey from that lofty height. With eyes like that, I could read the newspaper over the shoulder of someone who's not even on the same subway car. I'd never need an eye examination. Even if I did, I wouldn't have to go to the doctor's office. I could read the eye chart in his office while I was having breakfast in my own kitchen. Besides, it would be fun to have eyes that can spot small details over long distances. Ring. Hello. You don't know me, but I'm calling from the payphone across the street from your apartment building. I was looking through your kitchen window, and I noticed you have a little blob of food in the corner of your mouth. No, no, the other side. There, that's it. You got it. Click. For raw strength, I'd borrow the muscle tone of the bear. Those critters can pull apart an automobile when they know there's food inside. I'd love to have strength like that. I could accept impromptu arm wrestling challenges in bars all over the country. I'd not only win, but if I wanted to, I could take home the arm of the loser as a souvenir. There'd be no pickle jar I couldn't open, no suitcase too heavy for me to lift. With my same easy, fluid golf swing, I'd probably hit the ball 520 yards down the fairway. Yeah, it'd be nice to have the strength of a bear. For legs, I'd use those of a deer. Their speed, stamina, and jumping ability would be great for navigating troublesome rush hour traffic on the interstate. I could leap through, around, and over irritated drivers locked into their stalled lanes. A flip of my white flag as I bounce out of sight would be my only response to their invectives and angry hand signals. I'm going to throw in the prehensile tail of the possum. There must have been hundreds of times in my life when I'd had my hands full, yet there was still something left to carry. For instance, luggage at the airport. I've got a heavy bag in each hand, and my briefcase is sitting there. With my possum tail, I could pick it up and hustle out to the curb to get a cab. I could change channels on the television without having to put down either my can of soda or my popcorn. It would probably be useful in paper hanging, carpentry projects, things like that. It's just an added little luxury that might come in handy, sort of like the lighted makeup mirror on the sun visor of a car. I'd incorporate the persuasiveness of the skunk. If I had guests who were boring or who stayed too long, I'd give them a surreptitious spritz and they'd have their hats and coats on and be inhaling the relatively pleasant freeway fumes before I could finish the sentence. Oh no, do you have to go already? Yes, having the outstanding features of other animals built into my human body would be almost ideal. I say almost because I can think of two problems. I'd have trouble getting dates and suits that fit me properly. But so what? I have trouble doing those with this body. And this concludes, the optimum body may exclude the beautiful people. Gregory McNamee is the author of Wild River, a natural sanctuary for birds and desert creatures. The remote Bill Williams on Arizona's west coast remains a well-kept secret. Turkey vultures, to all appearances, are creatures of leisure. They prefer gliding on bumpy desert thermals to flying under their own power. They'd rather hunker down to a found meal than hunt for themselves. The ones you'll see perching atop Arizona's power lines and cliff edges seem almost like caricatures, emblems of easy living. But on one bright early March dawn, the turkey vulture perched just across the slender Bill Williams River from me had taken leisure to unusually laid-back extremes. Far from flying off in alarm at my approach, as just about any other bird would, this specimen of Cathartes aura greeted me with the avian equivalent of a yawn. The turkey vulture's nonchalance made me wonder whether or not it had encountered humans before. I suspect that it had not. The Bill Williams, easily Arizona's remotest, least visited river, lies far from paved roads except at its beginning in west central Arizona and its end at the Colorado River between Parker and Lake Havasu City. Only a handful of people know the Bill Williams well, and to the flood of Arizona literature, the river has contributed to just a few drops. It took me nearly two decades worth of collecting Arizona's wild places before I stumbled across it myself, finally filling in an uncharted quadrant of my personal map of exploration. Humans, I conjectured, were an equally rare find for its wild denizens. The Bill Williams River has languished as a footnote in Arizona history. Even the prehistoric record shows little evidence that humans settled there in any sizable number, and apart from a Yavapai wiki-up or two, the early European explorers found few signs of people living along the river. Major John Wesley Powell, who boated the length of the Colorado River in 1872, found the Bill Williams emptier still. The river did not impress him much. He wrote in his 1895 book, Canyons of the Colorado, "It is but a muddy creek. Judging by my sojourns along its clear course, Powell must have seen the Bill Williams on a bad day." Because it is so little known, this river represents a near-perfect slice of wild Arizona, especially hospitable during the half-year when the temperatures of the western desert remain subdued. Named after a famed mountain man and trapper who roamed the area in the 1820s and 1830s, the river rises in a broad valley among the low but rugged Rawhide, Buckskin, and Arastra mountain ranges, where the Big Sandy and Santa Maria rivers combine to form it. Both are perennial streams, and so the Bill Williams flows year-round, a rarity in this extremely dry part of the state, and a beacon to wildlife and flora of astonishing variety. Most Arizonans see the Bill Williams only at its upper reaches, 37 miles north of Wendon at Alamo Lake, a man-made reservoir that was completed in 1968. The lake boasts large populations of bass, bluegill, and catfish, prize catches that draw anglers from all over the country. On one quiet winter weekday, I counted license plates from California, Utah, Kansas, Florida, Michigan, and New Hampshire, along with those of several Canadian provinces and Mexican states. Dropping away from the lake's earthen dam, the Bill Williams River proceeds to flow 45 miles in a more or less east-to-west line to the Colorado River. It first tumbles down into a deep canyon with cliff walls reaching 1,000 feet. A switchback dirt road descends to the water. Hiking the canyon requires the intrepid packer to ford the stream several times, negotiating a way around big boulders and ragged tree trunks torn loose by occasional floods. The arduous journey is well worth the effort, for within the canyon stand thick groves of shade-giving cottonwoods and abundant wildflowers, the kind of place where the expression "getting away from it all" takes on a new meaning. If you stay long enough, unobtrusively enough, you'll likely even catch a glimpse of the upper river's resident nesting pair of bald eagles. The canyon opens about 8 miles downstream of the dam onto a fertile, wide valley reached through the network of graded dirt roads that run from State Route 72 to several points in the Bill Williams. One of those roads, from the Boose to the ghost town of Swansea, crosses through the transitional zone where Sonoran Desert saguaros and ocotillos begin to shade into the Joshua trees in creosote of the Mojave Desert, and where the geology changes from the interior's lava chaos to the solar desert's stabilized sand. Rockhounds have long found this transitional region fascinating, an imposing low landscape where every telephone pole comes equipped with its own lightning rod and, it seems, its own turkey vulture. Antonio de Espejo, a Spanish chronicler who traveled along the river in 1582, was one such rock hound. He reported finding silver ore so close to the surface that it can be dug by hand. Juan de Onate, the conquistador who founded the Spanish colony of New Mexico 16 years later, also found rich deposits along the river, but for reasons unknown, perhaps because of the river's distance from their settlements in Yuma and Tucson, the Spanish never established the mining posts that the land invited. It would be some 3 centuries before mining towns sprouted along the river's banks, most notably now-empty Swansea, founded in the mid-1890s. It once had a population of more than 1,000, a rail depot, several good restaurants, and a movie theater that offered the latest silent films. Every time I stand among Swansea's crumbling adobe ruins, which stretch out for a mile or so below the stern front range of the Buckskin Mountains, I find it hard to imagine that this silent place once thrived as an economic hub. On one warm spring evening there, in fact, my only company was a curious kit fox that scampered into my campsite as if to determine where the unaccustomed light of the campfire was coming from. Throughout the night, several more kit foxes came to call, accompanied by the braying of wild burros, a raucous chorus of coyotes, and once the faraway yowl of a mountain lion. Venus had risen, and the sky was a great carpet of stars, such as city dwellers like me rarely see. This is wild country, full of creatures not often found elsewhere in quite such abundance. Among the most ubiquitous are the wild burros, descended from renegades that long ago fled a prospector's lead or a miner's corral and headed for the hills. Through the years, these runaways adapted to the harsh desert climate by developing ability to store heat in their bodies and release it at night, something like a solar panel on the hoof. That adaptability has in turn led to an exploding population of these canny creatures, so much so that state wildlife control officers occasionally have to round them up and remove them from public lands. On the 6.5-mile road south to the Bill Williams River from Swansea, which drops roller coaster-like down steep hillsides and into narrow arroyos, great herds of burros stampede at the mere sound of a vehicle zigzagging to safety across broken terrain. This country remains a rough jumble of desert pavement and cholla cactuses, and the place names bespeak the nature of the region: the East Cactus Plain, the Rawhide Mountains, the Gibraltar Peak Wilderness. The Bill Williams River below Swansea offers a bonus for bird watchers, harboring avian and animal populations that have few equal parts in this sere part of Arizona. On my recent visit there in late spring, a flock of ducks took flight the minute I hit water. A turkey vulture spread its wings and rose up on its talons in a nice impersonation of Dracula. The dirt roads that run north of Swansea are easier to navigate, but they're long and winding. Even in a four-wheel drive vehicle, expect to cover only 10 to 15 miles an hour. The roads remain empty most of the time. One summer morning, driving down the long Planet Ranch Road, which branches off from the Swansea Access Road, I encountered just one vehicle, a battered pickup driven by a man who identified himself only as Teddy from Vegas. Following Espejo and Onati's example, he and a partner were installing an alluvial placer mining system on the Bill Williams River, hoping to make their fortune in gold. Teddy admitted that the pickings had been awfully slim, but he loved being tucked away on the remote river, far from the bustle of his hometown. About 15 river miles downstream from the ranch, the Bill Williams joins the Colorado at a reed-choked confluence surrounded by gnarled mountains. The noted Southwestern author, Mary Austin, who traveled along the river while writing her 1924 book, The Land of Journey's Ending, noted the many colored walls and then the long, winding slide to where the river turns at the junction of the two rivers, an access road to the Bill Williams River National Wildlife Refuge that emerges onto State Route 95 between Parker and Lake Havasu City. Between milepost 160 and 161, provides four-wheel drive access to those colored walls and the confluence. Even there, so close to the whine of tires on asphalt and the grinding gears of tractor trailers, the Bill Williams offers its visitors an ancient music that all too few people have a chance to hear. The distant calls of kingfishers, ducks, great blue herons, canyon wrens, the whirring wings of hummingbirds as they descend to feed on greasewood blooms, the slow, deliberate wing beats of hawks, egrets, and eagles. So much happens there that I always find myself adding to the music with the rat-a-tat riffle of fingers over the pages of my Audubon field guide as I vainly attempt to keep up. There, below tall volcanic cliffs, the crystal clear water of the Bill Williams River flows at a good clip, full of trout that peck insects off the floating bankside algae with alarming gulps, a wholly unexpected pleasure to find in this dry, sun-beaten, craggy country. Every one of my visits to its banks has brought some new epiphany, some new encounter with the wild desert. I cannot help but think of the remote stream, a well-kept secret even to long-time Arizonans, hard to get to and harder to forget, as a slender ribbon of Eden. And this concludes Wild River. Jean Parrott is the author of Maybe What It Takes to Find the Dutchman's Lost Gold is a Helpful Wife. Have you ever had one of those mornings when you wake up and the sun seems brighter, the air smells fresher, and colors are much more vibrant? That's the way this morning was for me. I went to breakfast full of enthusiasm, knowing all was right with the world. I now know how I'm going to make my fortune, I told my wife. For a man in his late 50s, that's commendable, she said. Well, almost all was right with the world. I didn't let her negativity affect me. I'm going to find the lost Dutchman's gold mine, I announced. I see, she said somewhat patronizingly as she scraped the black crust from some burnt toast. And where exactly is this lost Dutchman's mine? She was trying to trick me, but I wouldn't fall for it. Well, no one knows exactly where it is, otherwise it wouldn't be lost, would it? But it's somewhere in the Superstition Mountains. And so are the bones of a lot of the people who tried to find it. That's all right, I said. Less competition. People can die from looking for lost treasures, she said. I defended my position, though. Greed killed those people. They figured the world owed them a living. I'm not that greedy. I figure just Arizona does. Where'd you get this idea? She asked as two more burnt pieces of bread popped up. I watched a documentary last night about this lost gold mine, and all during the show I kept hearing, you're the man who's going to find it. You're the man who's going to find it. It was like the Dutchman was talking to me. My wife was unimpressed. All during his life he never talked. Now that he's dead, he has a chat with you? Well, he didn't actually talk to me, I said. I just know that if I go looking for the mine, I'll find it. I've always considered myself lucky. I married you, didn't I? A little soft soap, I figured, wouldn't hurt. My wife said, I've sometimes considered myself unlucky for the same reason. Okay, I thought, try another tact. Look, honey, he said, this gold mine is just sitting out there, and if I can find it, we'll be rich. You'll have a maid to do the dishes. We'll travel everywhere by chauffeur-driven limousine. I'll even get you a toaster that works. Which brings up an interesting point. How much is this going to cost? I felt I'd almost had her convinced. Not much. Maybe a few supplies, that's all. She said, you're going to need at least one other jackass. Apparently, I hadn't convinced her. She said, suppose you do find this gold mine. You don't know anything about gold. That's true, I admitted, but I've always been fond of it. Do you know how to spot gold in the ground? No. Do you know how to mine it, load it in carts, and bring it to the surface? No, not really. Do you know how to extract the gold and refine it? No. Do you know that no rich gold deposits have ever been found in the Superstition Mountains, and geologists, naturalists, and engineers all agree that it's an unlikely location for gold? Come on, what do they know? You're determined to try this, aren't you? She asked. Honey, it's a dream, I said. A fantasy. It's a gamble, sure, but every once in a while a man has to chase a rainbow. Go chase your rainbow, she said, but try to keep the cost down. We can't afford to waste money. That's my girl. I kissed her and rushed to get dressed. I was eager to get underway. I was going to be the man to find the legendary Lost Dutchman's gold mine. After I washed and dressed, I was going to go shopping for a few things I'd need. Honey, where are my tennis shoes? In the family room where you took them off, she answered. They were there. Have you seen my hat? It's in the hall closet, she answered patiently. My jacket? It's here in the kitchen, over the back of the chair. Thanks, I said, and kissed her and rushed out the door. I came back in. Without my even asking, she said, your car keys are on the credenza in the foyer. I picked them up and started out the door again. Before I left, though, I heard my wife mutter to herself, rest in peace, Dutchman. Your secret is safe. And this concludes. Maybe what it takes to find the Dutchman's lost gold is a helpful wife.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Deserts and streams rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams.